सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार, अ प्रोग्राम ऑन डेवलपमेंट इकोनॉमिक्स विद स्पेसिफिक रेफरेंस टू द पॉलिसी ऑफ पाकिस्तान। टुडे माय गेस्ट इज रजा रूमी, वेल नोन ऑथर एंड कमेंटेटर ऑन पाकिस्तान। मेनी ऑफ यू हैव heard his program with me before as well. We had a very interesting discussion on the course that he is teaching, leading to many observations on aid, growth, and the capacity and training of civil servants and government agents in Pakistan. I hope you enjoy it. Raza, you've been teaching at the Cornell Institute of Public Affairs. You've been teaching development economics and development administration. Am I right? Is that what you've been teaching?
That's exactly right. It is broadly public policy and development policy. Yeah.
Now tell me, what have you been teaching in that area?
So this semester, I'm actually teaching a course which is about rethinking international development and looking at the alternative paradigms and the practices and the challenges. You know, it is from a practitioner's point of view, so it is somewhat less theoretical. But the course generally looks at the way, the aid industry and the architecture of international aid works, and why is it not delivering? So that's the big question for the students, and I guess for me as well, to explore during the semester, that what are the particular causes that do not allow resources turning into results in so many countries across the globe.
So what are the three key lessons that you're learning or that you're teaching in this course?
I think that the key lessons from the course and from the readings that we have, I suppose, I mean, they are not really new, but I would list them in this order. The first one evidently has to do with the mismatch between country needs and donor priorities. And often that disconnect leads to, massive aid failures, you know. And I guess the second particular lesson, as you put it, from the experience of international development is that so much of aid is poorly designed and poorly administered, and there is very little accountability. So I would actually call accountability as the second one. You know, the donors then don't have internal accountability mechanisms because the incentives are different. And within countries, so much of aid comes in and there's nobody accountable or answerable as to why a particular aid package was accepted and why did it fail, and, who should be blamed or questioned for that. And the third, of course, has to do with the fact that the way we have bureaucratized aid industry, and we overlook local solutions, local thinkers, local ideas. There's an implicit white man's burden that still continues and ails the aid industry.
Fascinating. So three ideas you're saying, basically poor design, lack of accountability, and over bureaucratization. That's fascinating. Now tell me, how would you say that the lesson that you've learned in this course, presumably you're teaching this well, so how do you see Pakistan now after teaching this course? Policy in Pakistan and the way we run things in Pakistan through the prism of this course.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in part, this course that, you know, I designed it, largely based on my own practice in Pakistan and Asia Pacific when I was working for the Asian Development Bank. And that was the basis that made me raise all these questions while I was in the government, while I was with the ADB staffer, or even a freelance consultant. So, I mean, Pakistan sadly reflects all three of these ailments. I mean, you have been in a very crucial position, and you also know how our finance ministry is often ready to accept any program loan in Pakistan, whether it is needed or not, and even the terms are not really debated or discussed, and the country gets in indebted. And then so many programs have actually failed in Pakistan, you know, not even recently, but throughout the history of development administration. And rarely do we ever see anybody being held accountable for that. So, I mean, in Pakistan, I would actually place accountability as the key issue, because there is simply the accountability systems have broken down within the bureaucracy and even within the sort of parliamentary processes.
Mm-hmm. When you say that it's poor design, how do we judge the design? I mean, in the sense that the donors come in with a number of experts who design policy. Whereas on our side, we have no nobody who can even comment or think about the design. Or am I wrong? So how do we judge design?
Yeah, I mean, you know, our major problem is that our ministries in Islamabad, which historically have been dealing with aid, you know, particularly the Economic Affairs Division. And I mean, the Finance Ministry has somewhat better capacity. But, you know, the EAD generally is staffed by generalist bureaucrats, you know, from the sort of section officer to the deputy secretary or additional secretary level. I mean, the people who actually read and look at the stuff. And they are, are part of the civil service with very, you know, somebody's a history graduate and somebody's a sociology graduate or somebody's a mathematics or, you know, masters or even doctors. So many of them were joining the civil services in the 80s and 90s. So, I mean, you know, that expertise is missing. The expertise lies outside the government. And sadly, most of that expertise, as you know very well, also then is donor's consultant or advisor. And so there's a clear, clash conflict of interest and weak capacity. So I think that judging a design is obviously, you know, the key sort of ballpark or the bottom line there is the ownership. I mean, how far is a certain reform program or a certain project or a service delivery innovation owned by the country? And by the country, I don't mean a couple of bureaucrats, but you know.
When you tell me that the civil service is not aware of or not capable of evaluating the design of the program or the implementation, etc. And that they come from a generalist background or whatever, diverse background, which is the way it should be. But we have these very erudite and lovely large training academies all over the country. I admire the campuses and I see a lot of pomp and show. Are they not training them for policy design? Are they not training them for implementation?
Well, I think historically they have not at all trained them. I mean, only in recent years, you know, with this institution as the public policy school set up by the government, you know, which is basically in reincarnation of the older training institute. So they have come up, and I think they are now making some effort, you know, knowing how complex the global world is, and to train generations of managers and senior managers. But, you know, I went through that experience myself. Of course, it's, you know, it'll be two decades very soon. But I joined the DMG or now what is called as the administrative service. And much of what was actually being taught for most of that time were the laws, you know, because we were being trained as magistrates. As executive magistrates, so you had to read the criminal and the civil and the revenue laws, and then there were, of course, lectures by practitioners, senior civil servants, but there was very little attention to the scientific sort of approaches to public policy, which by then, even when I was there in the 90s, were evolving, you know, evidence-based policy making. How do you take risks? How do you calculate risks? How do you deal with multiple stakeholders? And that was often missing, unfortunately. And that, to my knowledge, is still missing. I mean, you know, they have made minor tinkering and cosmetic improvements, but they have to thoroughly scrap it and redesign it and get rid of the 19th century and the 20th century, statehood ideas that they have.
Let's take an example. What would you regard as a key public policy challenge in Pakistan today?
I mean, there are dozens of them, but I mean, let's take the provincial sort of taxation or provincial revenue raising or taxation at the central level. Now, you know better than I that most of the so-called tax reform work has been initiated by the IFIs, you know. And it is largely by them. It comes and goes, and they make the reports and they give compliance, and nothing happens on ground. And so, you know, and in these academies, again, you know, which deal with revenue services, customs, and income tax, etc., you know, the instruction is still pretty antiquated. They teach you the Customs Act or, you know, the income tax laws, etc., but then it doesn't really go beyond that. I mean, how do you create
Let me just take this up with you, because I've been quite vocal on this. Why would you regard taxation as a key public policy challenge? I would put it lower down on the list.
No, I know. I'm very familiar with your views. I was just citing as that in our public sort of discourse, in the political and media discourses, you know, this emerges again and again.
But the reason I'm pushing back, Raza, is that, unfortunately, yes, you're absolutely right. This is the number one priority of our government. This is the number one priority as given by donors. This is the number one priority on the media. But sadly, the way I look at it is that it is a number one priority primarily because nobody is thinking at home. Because donors come and present this and there is no pushback. The civil service does not push back. The media follows. Nobody pushes back. Whereas the problem is, for example, let me put it to you. The provinces don't need to tax. Why should the provinces tax? They're running a balanced budget. Why should the provinces tax? If they're going to tax to give the money to the federal government, then that's against provincial autonomy and the thoughts on provincial autonomy. So I see no reason why the provinces should tax more, because they're already running a balanced budget. They don't need the money for more taxation. On the federal level, for example, the federal government policy seems to be haphazard taxation. They tax milk, they tax internet, they tax school fees, they tax mobile phones, they tax... The system of taxation is so strange. Only thing it reminds me of is the Sheriff of Nottingham. What would you say to that?
Sheriff of Nottingham. No, I was just giving you an illustration. Of course, you know, there are multiple sort of debates on this, and your view is of course slightly unconventional, but definitely something that Pakistanis need to ponder.
I would argue it is not unconventional. Think about the austerity debate taking place in Europe and taking place out here right now. Right? Trump has got elected on this mandate that he will fix the tax system, right? And he will stop the austerity that has been practiced in the last 8 years. So I would argue it is not unconventional. This is the conventional view here. The only problem is it is unconventional out there because we're not having a debate on it.
There is no debate, sadly. And you know, this kind of debate has to be... You know, there are of course multiple levels of debates. I mean, there's public debate, and then there have to be avenues for internal debates as well. And you know, they are missing. The way the bureaucracy functions, it's pretty hierarchical and pretty top down as well, unfortunately. And those who differ or those who have different views on key issues are often either sidelined or not encouraged to speak up. So I think that also has to do with the policy, larger policy culture that we have. But I mean, you know, coming back to your question, you know, there are tons of challenges one can think of. I mean, look at why is Pakistan's private investment not growing? I mean, you know, that has been a quandary. I mean, you worked on the economic growth strategy as well. And, you know, things are not looking up. You know, we have injections through aid or through IMF or through other, you know, savings from the POL prices, etc. But the domestic investment is not doing or you know, the economy is not attracting the way...
I think that's a very, very good question. And quite frankly, I keep searching and I have not found anything that is either written or debated or discussed in the media or in intelligentsia or in academia. And that surprises me. Why is it that we do not discuss this very critical question that you're asking?
No, because we, our government wants to tell us that, you know, look, we got this IMF tranche, we got money from China. Now CPEC will take care of everything. We don't have to worry about that. China's investing, etc. But the reality is that our domestic investment is in a big major bind here, and and then that leads to a set of policy debates around that. I mean, what is preventing that? How can we improve it? But that sort of stuff, I mean, so this is the kind of things that at the Administrative Staff College, now rechristened as, you know, National School of Public Policy, they need to be training streams of managers, and that is why we need some classification, we need some concentrations, because you can't give, even public policy is taught in Pakistani administrative training schools as a generalist subject. And, you know, being at Cornell for these past few months, you know, I've realized how far complicated it is, and how things are taken so seriously here. And perhaps that is why the quality of policy making differs, you know, from
so
here.
So very quickly, just answer two questions because we want to keep this short. Well, first question: you say the School of Public Policy has transformed and become a good school. I just keep wondering as to because I keep hearing that their main method of teaching is to invite guest lecturers. Is that a good way to teach, you think?
No, not at all. I'll tell you, that is another big deficit, because these are not high priority areas for the executive, for the government. So they don't invest in proper faculty or trainers, you know. And they do, I mean, they have expanded staff and they have hired more people from the outside. But generally, the managers and people in key positions there are career civil servants themselves, who are waiting for their next, you know, lucrative or powerful posting before they can move on. You know, khudde line, the term used in Pakistan, where you want to sideline a civil servant. So generally, these academies have been that, those spaces. And, you know, that is a function of how the government, the parliament, and even the media and society look at these institutions. And it is not limited to the administrative training schools. Even in the judicial training, where I also worked, you know, a decade ago, I was part of ADB's Access to Justice program. One of its major objectives was to reform the training institutions. And sadly, we couldn't really do much. And, you know, it is still a struggle. And now you see this Lahore Chief Justice provides, tablets like iPads, and it's hailed as a big reform. The reality is that these institutions need full-time, highly trained, highly skilled faculty who can think of solutions and innovations with the trainees. And that still is missing. You still have the guest lecturer coming in, and that model simply has not worked, and it will not work.
Plus, also, they have two trainings. Civil servants have only three trainings in their period. One is at the beginning of the career. Second is at the one-third stage of their career. The third is the two-third stage of their career. They come in only once in each setup, and they have no incentive to learn. And the teachers have no incentive to teach. Is that the way?
Not at all. I think that needs to be relooked at. Right? But you know, even if this particular mid-career and senior and junior levels continue, you can do so much even within this framework. But, it is not getting the kind of priority. I mean, you know, to give credit to General Musharraf, I mean, that is when all of these restructuring took place. So there was this thinking to take it to another level. But as you know, in Pakistan, things are so unstable that you don't follow up on that. But I just want to add the last point here, which pertains to the necessity of also looking at, you know, there are a lot of Fulbright scholarships, there are a lot of Chevening scholarships which are availed by younger civil servants, you know, junior and mid-career. And, you know, the trend that I have also seen during my earlier career in the civil service and later as well has been that, you know, a lot of these trainings do not actually result in any value added, you know, work within the public sector. So other people who are trained in, let's say, agricultural development will be posted in home department. Or vice versa. Somebody trained in law will go to agriculture. And then a lot of these young civil servants, because, you know, they're frustrated by the system and the salary, they, with their foreign degree, they also start hunting for outside work. And that has reduced a bit, I believe, in the last 2-3 years, because the governments have become more strict. But generally, that has been the trend, that anyone coming back with a master's in public policy or public administration or economics would immediately get a consultancy job or a full-time job with a donor agency. And so I think this also has to be rethought, this whole paradigm, because it is completely not adding any value. And the classic case was this World Bank's public sector training program with millions of dollars, and which took people to Harvard's Kennedy School for masters or short courses. And and I think the starting point would be to look at those people, where did they go, what did they contribute, and
Raza, wasn't that just a joyride? From what I remember, all the people who took that were close to retirement, and they've also that was $60 million given to Harvard for this training, which I find so bizarre, and I think the World Bank needs to be faulted on that. Quite frankly, we have to repay that $60 million. I think if we had taken that $60 million and given it to some of our universities,
we would have set up a couple of good public policy schools in Pakistan with that money, to be honest. You know, $60 million is a huge money. And Nadeem, I will go back to the first part of our conversation. Here, there are three actors. There's the World Bank. There is the senior bureaucrats of Pakistan who signed off on that loan. And then, of course, there is Harvard itself. All three, in my view, sadly, were party to this disastrous arrangement. And, you know, it neither...
I mean, if we did it, we would call it corruption.
Right? Well, sadly, yes. Yes, that is and that is what I've been also teaching in my class, how various facets of corruption and malpractices in aid go on. I mean, 60 million Pakistanis are indebted. You know, my children and your children will actually end up paying in some indirect tax or whatever, property tax or whatever, to repay this amount. And the reality is that the public sector stands wherever it was. In fact, by all accounts, it may even have worsened over the years since that program was initiated. And I think that is a classic case that needs to be reminded again and again. And that could be a starting point for the change that we want to bring in this culture in Pakistan.
Raza, thank you very much. I think it's a very interesting, inspiring conversation. Although
yes,
I do admit
we shall continue
for hours, but we shall leave it at that and we shall pick up these threads later.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है.